This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So we risk losing that capacity and that capability on the continent if we are not able to receive orders in order to sustain lines.
That's Dr. Stavros Nicolaou, Senior Director of Aspen Pharmacare, the largest drug company in Africa, on the impact of not receiving a single order for COVID-19 vaccine since it began production in November. Details coming up. Also, Libyan Prime Minister-designate Fatihi Bashagha is calling for national dialogue to solve the country's political crisis. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Africa's first and only COVID-19 vaccine plant may be forced to close just a few months after opening due to lack of demand from the continent for its jabs. Aspen Pharmacare, the largest drug company in Africa, began manufacturing vaccines using ingredients provided by the Johnson & Johnson or J&J pharmaceutical giant at the facility in South Africa last year. Darren Taylor reports.
When J&J gave Aspen a COVID-19 vaccine manufacturing license last year, the move was heralded as a giant step forward for Africa. The continent had suffered a dire shortage of jabs during the pandemic, as richer regions focused on immunizing their own populations. To alleviate this shortage, Aspen began making millions of jabs.
The issue at hand here is that there have been no orders received for the product we licensed from Johnson & Johnson. The product is called Aspenovax. Aspenovax is the African vaccine for Africans.
Aspen Senior Director Dr. Stavros Nicolaou says it appears as if African governments don't want or think their people don't need COVID-19 vaccines, even though some countries, including South Africa, are entering a fifth wave of the pandemic with largely unvaccinated populations. During an online news conference, Nicolaou described the looming loss of Africa's first COVID-19 vaccination production lines as beyond tragic.
So we risk losing that capacity and that capability on the continent if we are not able to receive orders in order to sustain the lines. If we are unable to sustain them, of course, we will have to pivot back to manufacturing other things. But the real risk here is, I think we all know that we're not out of the woods as yet with COVID. We don't quite know what trajectory it will take next.
South Africa has been worst affected by the pandemic on the continent, with more than 100,000 deaths and 4 million cases. Yet vaccination rates remain low, just 30% of eligible people. The health department has 22 million doses in storage, a lot of which expire by the end of June. But people aren't queuing up to take them, even though South Africa's in a fifth wave and infections are rising once again. Nicolaou says the entire continent, not just South Africa, needs a wake-up call.
Africa's population is 1.3 billion. Now, Africa set itself a target to vaccinate 70% of its adult population, so that roughly would have translated to around 800 million Africans being vaccinated. The reality on the ground is that Africa is only 18%, so less than 20% vaccinated. The multilateral procurement agencies that procure these products for and on behalf of Africa need to start placing orders with African producers such as Aspen. So right now, all the vaccines that have been procured through these facilities have not come from Africa. And what we are looking for is either orders or a strong signal that there will be procurement from Africa.
He says if African governments don't find the political will to reignite vaccination drives and do their best to prevent complacency, the Aspen vaccination production lines will stop. Nicolau wants Africans to cast their minds back 18 months when the continent had next to no vaccines and international institutions were lamenting Africa's incapacity to produce jabs. That's what sparked Aspen's partnership with J&J to make an African vaccine.
Can we afford to lose this capacity on the continent? And there are other capacities being planned, but why even plan them or execute them if Aspen's not going to get this right? Then we will get it right. We'll have to live with the fact that we don't have capacity on the continent to make COVID vaccines, and that for me is untenable and inconceivable.
Others in the health sector are less diplomatic, saying African leaders don't have the right to condemn Western nations' hoarding of vaccines if they themselves don't care about their own people. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Organizations representing foreign nationals in South Africa warn that Johannesburg's new law that restricts immigrants from trading in the informal sector in the country's commercial hub will be a big blow to thousands. Most foreign nationals in South Africa survive through informal trading due to high unemployment levels. Johannesburg currently has over 14,000 official informal trading permits, but city authorities say the number will be cut to 8,100. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Nkululeko Mbundu, a member of the Johannesburg's Mayoral Executive Committee, says the new law seeks to bring order and adherence to the city's bylaws. Mbundu told the media that the new law will ensure that there is no illegal trading while protecting the rights of legal traders. A digital permit system will verify the status of the trader with their photo and fingerprints and a barcode card linked to the central database.
We've got a foreign invasion in our informal trade as well as puzzle shops. And, you know, I think we have a responsibility to protect the people of South Africa first. You know, we're hoping that all those 8,100 are occupied by South Africans, but we're going to do it within the law.
Mbundu admitted it is against the law to ban asylum seekers from trading, but insisted that they will be accommodated after serving South Africans. Lucia Moyo, a Zimbabwean mother of three, has been selling vegetables on the streets of Johannesburg since her arrival in South Africa 3 years ago. It has allowed her to put food on the table and pay her children's school fees and rent. She told VOA that the new law will bring the life of her entire family to a standstill.
I see a lot of criminality coming because of this, and a lot of confusion, pain and suffering and commotion in the process.
But South African national Siyanda Mohale fully supports the regulations.
I don't see anything wrong with that. Nowhere in the world can you go to another country and apply for a work permit to be an informal trader. Leave that for the locals to fight over those scraps alone.
Over the years, hundreds of thousands of African migrants have flocked to South Africa in search of jobs. However, with the national unemployment rate at 35%, many have been forced to resort to selling vegetables and other foodstuffs on the pavement. Ngakuthi Mabena, chairman of the Zimbabwe Community in South Africa organization, says they are very keen to see how the city will implement the new law. He says it is not true that migrants have taken up all the informal trading stands.
Most of the stands are registered under South Africans. The South Africans then rent out the stands to migrants. The effect will be if at the stand itself, migrants are evicted by police.
Since the beginning of the year, a vigilante group calling itself Operation Tudula or Chase Out has gone around the country forcing foreign informal traders to leave the trading spots for South Africans. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, an arrest warrant has been issued for television journalist Pero Luwara after he criticized the government of President Felix Tshisekedi. On his YouTube news channel, CPAL-TV, Luwara said that Tshisekedi was a worse president than his predecessor, Joseph Kabila. Reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma tells VOA's Kate Bond Dawson that it is not clear what the charges are against Luwara, as it is not illegal to criticize the government.
And it's because he did on a TV show critics against the president, and he was comparing Tshisekedi to Joseph Kabila, and he said that Joseph Kabila was good president than Etienne Tshisekedi. And 2 days after that, he's now wanted, and it's for everybody because the prosecutor said all security and intelligence agencies are active in looking for him.
The charges are insulting the government. Is that correct?
So we don't know how and why the prosecutor can make the warrant against a journalist doing his job. Because comparing a president to his predecessor is not a crime. And the bad thing is this is just 2 days after the press day in the world. So this shows that journalists still in a danger. We don't have the freedom in the DRC.
Now, I understand that Mr. Luwara has not been actually detained. Is there any information about where he is?
No one knows where he is. Now, he left his home. He was not found at his home. And he posted on his Twitter that they will not get him, he will not let them to catch him, and he will not surrender because he didn't do any crime.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Kitanti in Goma in the eastern DRC. He was speaking to my colleague Kate Bondawson. As Jafar noted, World Press Freedom Day was on Tuesday, 2 days ago. Also, in more news from the DRC, the World Health Organization said today that health authorities have confirmed a third Ebola case in the city of Mbandaka in the northwestern part of the country. Reuters News reported today that a male patient was in contact with the first patient who died on April 21st. Health workers started Ebola vaccinations last week in Mbandaka and are monitoring the health of contacts of the confirmed cases. I'm your host, Yehei Suhib, and you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Libyan Prime Minister-designate Fathi Mbashaga, in his Eid message, announced a national dialogue to reach a true national consensus to which all groups, without expectation, will be invited. He said that force would not be used to take over the seat of government in Tripoli. His proposal aims to solve the political crisis in Libya, created when former UN Special Representative to Libya, John Kubis, backed the rival Abdelhamid Dabiba's government, saying it can only be replaced by an election. Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Jan Kubis argued that the Dabiba government enjoys legitimacy because it has been internationally recognized and was also endorsed at the Paris conference in November last year, assuming that there would be elections in December. And they stated, I'll quote, "We commend the efforts led by the interim government of national unity to take the necessary measures to ensure a democratic handover of power to the new government resulting from the elections. As we know, there were no elections. And to be honest, I don't believe that the conclusions of an international conference of the Paris conference are really enough to provide ongoing legitimacy to the Dabeba government. Kubis now hopes that Dabeba will organize at least orderly parliamentary elections at the end of June. I have some doubts." Bashagha's tactics to assume power failed for the time being. At first, he tried a quick rush to Tripoli. It failed. He tried to cut off the Beba from the oil revenues. It failed for the time being after the transfer of $8 billion of formerly frozen money from the National Oil Corporation to the Central Bank of Libya in mid-April. He tried to isolate the Beba in Tripoli. I would say quite limited success, as the Beba is touring around in Greater Tripoli and Misrata areas. Now, Bashagha's national dialogue, which aims to communicate directly with all parties to reach a national consensus, is an attempt to regain momentum. I need to say I have also some doubts that this will work. The Beba, for example, will certainly not participate in this dialogue. Altogether, I need to say the chances of Bashagha to take over as a prime minister are slowly but steadily diminishing.
So far, there were no clear positions of the US or the European Union on the power struggle between Bashagha and the Beba. Should the US and the European Union recognize the Bashagha as the legitimate prime minister, or at least mediate a compromise to end the political crisis in Libya?
Bashagha's attempt of isolating the Beba internationally has also failed. Just a day ago, Bashagha wrote an op-ed for the British Times pledging to support the UK and Europe in the current crisis with Russia and, quite interesting, to expel the Wagner mercenaries from Libya. He obviously tries to get at least British backing. But with the notable exception of Egypt backing Bashagha and Algeria supporting the Beba, most of the important international players keep out of the dispute. The Beba traveled to the Emirates, Bashagha traveled to Turkey, but both failed to get any official meetings. The Beba planned to go to Tunis. The trip was called off by the Tunisians. I would say somehow this hesitation is understandable, as no one wants to bet on the losing horse, and it is still not yet sure who will prevail. But let me stress, if the Beba stays on as a prime minister, there is a high risk that the situation will significantly deteriorate over a few months. Probably that's also a reason why still no one of the other major players supports him officially, and this includes, remarkably, also Turkey. But I would not recommend to officially recognize the Bashagha government, as it is not up to the United States and to Europe to decide who rules Libya. That's up to the Libyans. Nevertheless, I would recommend them to work behind the scenes on a handover of power of the Beba to Bashagha, for example, by pushing the Central Bank of Libya to work together with Bashagha and not to support the Beba anymore. Or they should look at least for some kind of compromise to contain the endemic corruption and to ensure that the oil revenues are more evenly spent all over Libya.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya. He was talking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. The announcement by Guinea's military junta that the transition to civilian rule will take 39 months could lead to greater pressure from regional bloc ECOWAS. Ibrahima Kane, head of the African Union Advocacy Program at the Open Society Institute of West Africa, said an ECOWAS delegation will be in Guinea's capital next week to meet with the junta. He told reporter Ricky Shryock that he thinks the timeline will need to be a jumping-off point for negotiations, or ECOWAS may resort to stricter sanctions for the West African country.
Does ECOWAS not already have sanctions on Guinea's junta leaders? And what would these economic sanctions look like? What kind of impact would this have in Guinea? But the stopping of those transactions impact the economies of other West African countries as well? When we talk about transition to civilian rule, what have civil society organizations and the political parties said they want? As I understand it, that they've condemned this plan mostly.
That was Ibrahim Kane, head of the Africa Union Advocacy Program at the Open Society Institute of West Africa, speaking from Dakar with reporter Ricky Shryock.
The Basketball Africa League is back. Voice of America joins forces with Africa's premier men's basketball league to bring you the second season of the BAL. It is game on March 5th, 2022. 38 games, 12 teams leaving it all on the court in Senegal, Egypt and Rwanda to determine the 2022 season champion. Tune in to VOA 24/7, FMs and to our radio and TV affiliates for some action. Pre-game, play-by-play, post-game, daily highlights, delivered by our finest commentators. Basketball Africa League 2022 on Voice of America. May the best team win.
Somalia's long-delayed presidential election process is finally expected to come to an end on May 15th, despite a series of disruptive terror attacks by the Al-Shabaab extremist group and a feud between the president and the prime minister. The country faces a May 17th deadline to establish a new government or face a halt to budget support from the International Monetary Fund. Under Somalia's indirect electoral process, clan elders select the 275 members of the lower house, who in turn choose the president. More than a dozen candidates are expected to compete. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturday.